So, over to you, Paramananda.
Oh God, that was quick. And we got some introductory remarks.
No.
And we got any sort of science fiction trivia. Okay. So, right. Well, we're just going to meditate. So, get yourselves comfortable. Get myself comfortable. And we're going to do a very simple little heart meditation, which I'll just lead you into and leave you to it largely. Let's just come to the breath straight away. So everything we do, we're doing within the sort of felt context of the breath. So as you breathe in and out, just relax your legs and just consciously seeing if we can let go in the legs, particularly the thighs and the hips there. Just giving the weight of the legs to the ground. And then just feeling into the sitting bones, base of the pelvis there. And we want the feeling of the torso dropping directly down to the pelvic girdle into our heavens, supporting us, cushion or chair. Maybe particular attention if you're sitting in a chair, really. Try and make sure that your weight is going down from the sitting bone into the chair. And that your feet ideally should be just flat on the floor. If you are sitting on a chair, again, ideally, might not be your hips should be just a little bit higher than your knees. It's usually worth just angling the chair by putting something under the back leg. You're not using the actual back of the chair as support. You're still holding yourself up if possible. As we breathe in and out, let's just very gently push the back of the head up towards the ceiling, opening up the base of the skull a little bit, letting the chin drop perhaps a fraction, but not so far as it feels like it's constricting in the throat. Imagine your nose being in line with your navel. Let's have a sense of our environment, room, place we're sitting in. And also extending a little bit outside. Be aware of the earth and the sky. Maybe there's some nice woods or trees near you. Even if you're in a built environment, a city, still perhaps have some sense of natural world. Even a city like London's got quite a few wild animals in it, the birds and the foxes. Rodents. Anyway, we're just breathing in now. Feeling the length of your back. Keep breathing in and out. as you release the pelvis and release the head in the opposite direction. Imagine the back lengthening and broadening as you breathe. Let your face relax, particularly the mouth and the jaw, and soften a little if you can. What we're going to do is very simple. We're just going to imagine breathing in through the back of the heart area and breathing out through the front of the heart area and breathing in through the front, out through the back, in through the back, out through the front. So we breathe out and in on the same side. So we're just imagining the kind of energetic horizontal breath, but also aware of our normal, more vertical feeling breath. Just breathing in through the back of the heart and imagining breathing out through the front of the heart. Breathing in through the front of the heart. Imagine breathing out through the back of the heart. So just engage in our imagination a little bit. Trying to base it on a felt sense. So it's just quite a gentle way of beginning to sort of warm the heart up a little bit, just a little bit. We feel a bit disconnected or numb in the heart area. This very simple, gentle way of staying with our heart. as you breathe, your heart hears that. Miroslav Hollows, what the heart is like. Officially, the heart is oblong, muscular, and full of longing. For anybody who has painted a heart knows that it is also sometimes spiked like a star, sometimes bedraggled like a stray dog at night, sometimes powerful like an archangel's drum, sometimes gaily round like a ball in a net, sometimes a thin line, and sometimes an explosion. And in it is only a river, a weir, and at most one little fish, hardly noticeable at first sight, and by no means golden, more grey, jealous though. Anybody who has painted a heart knows that first he had discard his spectacles, put away his fine point pencil and graph paper, and walk for a long time outside. Sometimes spiked like a star, sometimes bedraggled like a stray dog at night, sometimes powerful like an archangel's drum. Just notice what you're doing, what's happening. Notice if you've moved away from the heart. Before we finish, gently come back. Breathing the heart. Imaginatively, horizontally, through your body. Face relaxed. Throat.
So thank you, Paramananda. And maybe we'll take a little while surfacing at the end of that meditation. I know I went quite deep. And yes, when people feel like it, this is an open space to share, explore experiences during the retreat, during your meditations or anything else. And just unmute yourself if you'd like to, or if you want to be more private, you could post a private message to Pranyanita and she'll read it out for you. So anything that's resonated so far?
Hello.
Hello, is that you, Peter?
That's me, yeah, hi. There's two things. One is that we missed our group because we had a meeting and we couldn't make our group, so we're sorry to miss out on our group. But we really enjoyed it yesterday. But earlier on, I loved the meditation when we were lying down and you were playing the bowls and the gong. I think it was really, I wasn't expecting it. It was a fantastic surprise. And it worked, the sound worked really well, actually, even for Zoom. It really resonated in the room, or in my head anyway. I'd love to do that again during the retreat. Have you got any plans?
I don't know about this retreat. I could do. I certainly will do it again over time in other contexts, maybe even in person if you come around to the centre sometime.
Yeah.
But so I'm just interested about what was it about it? What happened? What did you experience while that was happening?
Well, it was almost like a kind of guided meditation, but being guided by the resonating sounds. It's sort of with a certain, I think, was it two bowls you had, isn't it? One was deep and one was high pitched, and a gong. I think that was I think that's what it sounded like. And it was just, well, it was a nice sort of soundscape on its own. But there was a sort of those particular tones of those bowls. I don't know, it's had a nice kind of resonating thing. I felt it in my chest almost, and felt a kind of a way of relaxing and opening up to that sound.
There's a relaxing and opening up. And what was it that was opening up?
I felt like my chest was physically opening up. There's something you have quite a lot of tension and have a lot of crunchiness in my chest. And it felt like it was warming up and relax, you know, kind of sinking down.
It's interesting where you're putting your hand is very much in the area of the heart.
Yeah.
You talked about opening up and warming up.
Yeah. It's very much what I had my hand on.
Well, I think sound's interesting because it's one of those things that's quite primal and does go to a bit more of our sort of like reptile brain, you know, and we have associations and memories and things that can easily get evoked by sound. And some sounds can sort of make us more anxious and some of them can make us sort of like relax. I mean, for me, I suppose the context of a singing bowl is associated with meditation, retreats and all those kinds of things. So even if I'm not thinking about it, it probably has those associations. Plus, you know, if the sounds are nice for me, it has an effect. Well, it is a meditation. I mean, it's a meditation with sound as the focus, but you don't have to focus in a tight way. You can have something in your awareness and just sort of, there is just pure awareness of the sound rather than thinking about something. You know, like, so it's good to hear that was your experience. How did anyone else get on with that?
I could share something. It's Rachel in Scarborough. I had a good opportunity to practice during the singing bowl because up here where I live, as you can hear at the moment, there are F-16s flying low, and just as I was preparing to enjoy the beauty and the depth of that really deep bowl, an F-16 flew really slowly and very low overhead over my bungalow, making the windows vibrate and my sternum. So I was kind of the vibration from your singing bowl was coming through via the F-16, and while I had the opportunity to not want the F-16 to be there, the aversion kicked it. You know, there was a hint of a glimpse of aversion. I don't want this F-16 flying over here because it's not the experience I want. Craving. It actually just made me chuckle, and the F-16s continue, and so do the sound, and so does the practice, and all around the globe, someone somewhere is doing a mantra, and all around the globe, somewhere, singing bowls are singing, and so yeah, there's this really, really deep sense of connection, and plenty of opportunity to practice.
Thank you for sharing that, Rachel. And well, it struck me very much how you're sort of, you did use that as an opportunity for a deeper practice, and you know, like insight practice and connection with everything. And I think sounds very interesting because yes, we do have our Vedana responses to any experience, including sound, and that's often before we've even thought about it. You know, that we like a sound or don't like a sound. I have sometimes, as an exercise in Vedana, done a different kind of a sound meditation where I mix in with sounds that people might find pleasant and sound might find unpleasant, you know, and it's amazing like how strong people's reactions are. And when you're trying to get the idea of Vedana across, something like that can help a lot, because a sound is just a sound, but then we have these strong reactions to it, don't we? We like it, we don't like it, and then the whole series of other reactions on that. And I used to be really, really extreme with that, partly because of being a musician and being quite sensitive to sound. And I still work with it in certain contexts, like Christmas time and Muzak everywhere you go. But what I have found quite interesting is, like, you know, the views I might have about sounds, or thinking that it's, if I go into it thinking, oh, this sound is going to distract me or get in the way of my meditation, then it for sure does, because I just get in this whole kind of resistance to it. And my whole experience is all about the resistance, and so much energy goes into that or whatever. Whereas, like, you just had that opportunity there where you had the F-16 and it must have, to make your windows and your body vibrate like that, it must have been pretty loud and pretty close. And I think most people would have found that a very unpleasant laden art. And then, you know, what you did with that is really, I think, a testament to your practice.
It's Sue speaking here. I was just thinking of the kind of gong baths that I've done on some yoga retreats with those massive Tibetan gongs, and I always try to get quite near to them, so I get sort of, or if you're in I go to Sami Ling and they've got some of those big gongs there, and part of the service they kind of bash quite hard. And again, I really like feeling those vibrations come through. And with the sound bath, somebody is very skilled doing it, it just changes and moves around, and you're just taken on a journey with it. And it's nice that you just surrender to it and you don't use your brain or effort at all. I just really like doing that.
And it's really key what you're just saying there about surrendering and not making any effort. Anything I think that can help us get into that sort of frame of mind of not, okay, maybe I'm not, I'm sure Pramod might pick me up on this, because I think there is sometimes effort needed, but there is, I think we do have a tendency to often push and try too hard, and that bit of the ego resisting or clinging or wanting to be in charge and control of things or fix things, it's often when we can get into that state where we are letting go and relaxing, that sort of ego sort of doesn't have so much control in the same way. And I think anything like chanting a mantra or listening to sounds or doing devotional practice or something can get us into a different frame of mind to help that happen. that sort of letting go.
Truckman here. On that point of letting go with the sound bath, it was really relaxing during, and I let go, but I felt I had very extreme tiredness after that particular practice compared to the other ones. And not that it was a bad tiredness, I felt like it was related to how relaxed I was, but I just noted how it took me a while to get on with my day after that particular one, because I felt a real release, and hence the sort of physical, mental exhaustion that went with that, I think.
Tom, Wanda, do you want to say anything?
I don't know necessarily. I was just thinking, you know, I think when we do relax, we often do experience sadness, so the underlying kind of fatigue in a lot of people, in the kind of life we lead, you know, lifestyles we have, tend to be quite full on, don't they? You know, we tend to be busy a lot of the time. More in a slightly kind of fight-flight state a lot of the time, so if we do manage to relax fully, you know, I think it's very common for people to feel tired. I mean, you get it at the beginning of retreats, don't you? A lot of people suddenly start sleeping an enormous amount. So, well, most people probably should sleep more than they do. I think the brain, to use that word, needs quite a lot of rest. Really, you know, it needs that sort of relaxation, sleep to integrate experience.
Yeah, it's interesting, that thing, isn't it? Because often we're running on empty in a little bit. We're pushing ourselves and we're not listening to our bodies, and we're just and then when we do stop, then it all comes, you know, we've got an accumulation of tiredness. And certainly I noticed when I went on this retreat, and luckily there was a couple of days for the team before, but I was just so knackered, and I did actually decide to miss one of the evening sessions and just rest because of that. And even, I suppose it's different if you're on a physical retreat, you have the journey and you get there and you kind of know, you can see people are adjusting to the situation, but also, you know, you can't really do it on a weekend retreat, but when you've got a longer retreat, often it'll take 2 or 3 days for people to sort of rest and relax and then be able to engage more fully. But I think that can also happen on an online retreat, but it's sort of, you experience it differently because you're still probably doing other stuff around it. But in terms of that deeper relaxation, do you want to say a little bit more about what that was like? Or
I think it wasn't effortful. I think that was the main thing. I was just being carried by the sound, and had a lot of sensations in my body, sort of tingling sensations and things which I haven't really experienced from meditation. I'm kind of focusing on my breath. I think sometimes I push too hard to try to keep my mind quiet, and the sound sort of just lent itself to me following it. I didn't have to try. So that kind of, I got a lot of positive feelings from that experience, whereas the other types of meditation, I sort of, there's more effort required, some more, sometimes cognitive effort required. So it's, I don't get as many, I get some pleasant feelings, but moments where I know I'm drifting off and I have to kind of bring myself back, whereas I didn't drift at all. I just stayed with the sound.
It's interesting, isn't it, when you weren't feeling you had to and making the effort that you didn't drift. And I am, there were a lot of haves and shoulds in there. I'm just wondering what it would be like if you approach some of your other practices, whether it's metta or mindfulness or whatever else you do, with a little bit more openness and less expectation and more receptivity, rather than trying to make something happen.
Yeah.
Or maybe just seeing what was going on in your mind and being interested in it, that it might be a bit busy this time, but, you know, just sitting with that rather than I need to focus and stop it happening. Because that does require a lot of energy.
Thank you.
I mean, the word absorption is quite interesting, isn't it? When you, I don't know, well, you're talking about that like a sound bar. It's like you're relaxing into something, aren't you? And because it's got a kind of objective existence, you know, the sound makes it, you know, a lot easier just to release into that, I suppose. I was a little bit, I mean, maybe, I'm sure I'll talk about this more later on, but I mean, in a way, I don't think there should be mental effort when we meditate. I mean, the effort is in maintaining the posture. It's not to control the mind. Partly because it doesn't really work, But any effort we make when we're in a meditation posture is about maintaining and opening the posture, really, which redirects us from our cognitive to our felt experience. So it works, that's how it kind of works. When we start working about the physicality of our experience rather than the mentality of our experience, in a way we just let the mind do what it wants. I mean, obviously this is quite a loose way of talking because there's not that separation, but you know, we can pay attention to our, anyway, we're hopefully what we're trying to do in this retreat in particular is make the heart centre, the focus, rather than the cognitive centre, which I think most of us imagine in our frontal lobe, you know, somewhere in our brain. You know, I don't think we really do think in our brain, actually, but that's another story. That's really a cultural way of imagining, you know. But what we're trying to do here is drop down and have the heart rather than the brain as a centre, And because we move the brain somewhat onto the periphery or the orbit of the mandala, it shouldn't concern us too much in a way. It does what it does, doesn't it? When we start addressing the felt experience behind thought itself would tend to diminish. Thought's a kind of tertiary or sort of reaction to felt experience. don't know if that made sense, but there you go. Just the sound. I mean, that's why sound's so effective, of course, because sound is also direct experience. Our senses are direct experience, rather than a commentary on experience, which is what our cognitive experience normally is.
It was me, it's Rachel again.
I
love that question or that suggestion of is it in the brain where we think? And I love the playfulness of that, and I love the fact that we never know. And I can relax around these questions and be very hold them very lightly, and I think I've learned over time to apply this to my practice. You know, when these big deep questions come, to hold them lightly and relax into perhaps that we'll never know the mystery of our experience.
Well, you open up another huge question there, don't you? What is it to know? You know? What is it to know? I think really to know is also a felt experience, you know, rather than an idea about an experience. You know, is to what extent is knowing ever really contained within information? You know, I know that. Can't think of what his name is. Biden is the president of America, but what does that really mean? What is there any real knowing in that, or is that just a few bits of information? You know, I don't know what. And then it's an interesting question, isn't it? What is it to know? And what is it to know? Is there a different knowing that we have with the heart? You know, we sort of know when we're in love, don't we? Because it's this sort of physical. Or we know when, you know, we encounter beauty, because it's this kind of physical experience. Which you might have all sorts of anxiety and ideas around. But yeah, all very interesting questions. And, you know, great that you said that, Rex, because I mean, really, we're trying to open, aren't we? So we have to sort of open these questions as well and not expect some definitive answer. Sometimes I find Buddhism a little bit difficult in a way, because as though Buddhism's got an amazingly sophisticated kind of psycho-spiritual map, it's also can be a little bit kind of mechanistic, you know. You know, this happened because this happened and this happened. A little bit too kind of sure of itself sometimes. I mean, obviously depends on what Buddhism you are, but it's where I think experientially, of course, things are, as you say, much more mysterious in a way. When we start talking about,
I think it's more what we do with it, isn't it? Because there's always that idea of the whole of the Dharma just being a finger pointing to the moon, and that you use it to get across the shore and then you don't worry about it. You know, it's just this raft. You're not clinging attached to the teachings and the practices. But I think we do. And I think we do get very literal with particular teachings. Because we want that result. We want to fix things, or we want to have a very clear roadmap. certainly I know, well, it's especially there in beginner's courses, but I think not just that, that people ask questions and they want an answer and they want you to tell them something, and that this is the truth forever kind of thing, regardless of circumstances and conditions and individuals, that you give them a reply that they can then think is the truth forever, and get very frustrated if you're not willing to do that.
I don't want information, I know, very often.
Yeah.
I think that's what characterises our age, really, it's the information age, isn't it? We've started to not be able to distinguish information from knowledge. You know, knowledge implies some kind of embodied experience, where information is just information. And I think that is what is characteristic of our culture, really, now living in a culture of information. We don't need to know anything anymore, do we? Because we can just ask Google instantly on our phone, you know. We don't need to know anything.
Yes.
We don't need to remember anything at all. By hand, if people like me.
Though I accidentally had my phone and pressed Siri. Not that I've ever actually used Siri.
Carefully, so you're accidentally device.
Well, it might be, but that was when we were doing the chanting and it kept on saying, I don't understand what you're saying. Would you like to repeat that? Yeah.
Fantastic. I'll have to think about that. Yeah. But I am very interested in this sort of what it means to know something, really. What do we mean by that? And what?
To know and be known.
Know and be known, yeah. To be known, what does it mean to be known? Do we have a longing to be known as well? Slightly different, but I think we do have a longing to be known.
Yes, well, I think I do. And I think that's one of the appeals for me of Amitabha, that sense that he sees the uniqueness of us all.
Mm.
You know, all our qualities, all our...
Yeah.
Anyway, it is getting time to end.
What is time?
Well, that's another very interesting question, isn't it?
That's
it. So Ruth posted something in the chat about in French and Spanish they have different words for to know a person and to know something. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, that is interesting. Doesn't surprise me somehow that the Spanish would have that. Yeah. I know the Spanish mainly through the poetry, but a lot of Spanish poetry is very hard, really. Anyway. Well, as some of the art is fantastic.
Okay, so let's end there. So hope to see you all tomorrow. There'll be another morning meditation at 8, 10:30 session. Paramananda will be giving a talk and leading us in some practice. And afternoon will start with groups, but we may or may not do Q&A. We might do some more practice or some devotional practice. We'll see.
I'm going to endeavour to keep the... You know, I don't like you saying it's a talk. I am going to endeavour to keep that quite short. I'd like to do quite a nice, solid session of practice, during which we'll have a different sound experience.
Good. Yes. Well, I think sound, yes, and music opens the heart.
Well, not without music. Anyway, that's it.
Yeah.
Lovely to see you with you all.
Okie dokes. Take care.
Yeah. Bye, guys.
Thank you. That was really lovely.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
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 Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.